KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. This is Roger Goldman. We've got Nate Larson on the phone from ABC4. Maybe he can tell us that they fixed the thermostat and the heat will stop. I don't know, Nate. What are we looking at?
Yeah, Roger, wish it was simple as that. Unfortunately, we're going to be still in it for the next few days with temperatures flirting with record highs. High pressure still in place, centered over southern Utah today, still pushing up that hot and dry southwest flow. Eventually, moisture is going to creep into the area. In fact, we'll see more cloud cover starting tomorrow in Park City. Temperatures today, though, still in those low to mid 90s. 93 is expected for Park City with quite a bit of sunshine. Heber at 100 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on Saturday, and by Sunday, we'll see partly to mostly cloudy conditions with a slight chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms. It's very hit and miss as monsoon moisture moves up from the south. So temperatures will start to cool off a little bit due to some of the cloud cover. Highs near 90 on Sunday to 87 on Monday. And then we should hover in those mid to upper 80s through middle of next week. So average high temperature about 80 degrees for Park City this time of year will be about 5 to 10 degrees above average again by middle of the week after 85 on Monday. As far as Heber goes, we've got 100 today and tomorrow, partly cloudy skies, mid-90s on Sunday. Chance of showers and storms for the Wasatch Back will continue through about Wednesday before it clears out. So partly cloudy conditions through then, 92 for the high on Wednesday with temperatures back into those mid-90s as it towards middle and latter half of next week. More sunshine moving back in as well.
So, Nate, I know that yesterday Salt Lake City flirted with a high. Have there been any record highs broken, and are we looking at any over the next week, do you think?
Yeah, so certainly we had, I think, 8 cities that had record high temperatures yesterday across the Wasatch Front. So Airport had 106. 104 was the previous record. And we are expected to have a record high again today and tomorrow, which our all-time record high temperature is 107, excuse me. I was looking at the high temperature record for Park City today is 97. 107 for Salt Lake, and we're expected to hit that tomorrow. Today we're going to be 106, so record highs through Saturday, and then we start to relax a little bit. We're still in the upper 90s next week, but record potential for many areas today and tomorrow.
All right, thanks, Nate, and stay cool.
Yep. Yeah, you too. Bye.
KPCW News time is 8:09. Coming up, I will be speaking with Peyton Hawkins of the Salt Lake Tribune about her reporting on the Park City Senior Center. Then, I'm excited to be joined by Mark Gaber of the Campaign Legal Center. He was the lawyer who argued the case that resulted in yesterday's blockbuster ruling by the Utah Supreme Court on redistricting. We're going to finish our hour by chatting with Park City Councilmember Jeremy Rubel about last night's council meeting. Stay tuned. Let's do some local news. After 14 years of negotiations, Park City is acquiring the 26 acres of open space in Round Valley through a land exchange. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
The 26 acres, known as the Red Maple Parcel, is located just off State Route 248 in Quinns Junction. Park City has long wanted the land for long-term open space, but a deal to purchase it has been stalled since 2015. In June, however, the U.S. Air Force signed off on a land swap, according to a memo outlining the agreement obtained by KPCW. Decades ago, the U.S. Congress gave the land to the Air Force as compensation for a demolished ski lodge in Snow Basin that offered discount rates to active and retired military members. The deal required the Air Force to partner with a private or governmental entity for construction, as no dollars were appropriated for the project, just the land. The Air Force initially intended to build a new resort on the Red Maple property in Park City. Instead, it approached the Military Installation Development Authority, or MIDA, about developing in Wasatch County. MIDA is a state-created governmental entity with the purpose of serving active military and veterans. It creates revenue for its programs by partnering with local government entities to invest in economic development projects. MIDA's project area in Wasatch County includes the Grand Hyatt Deer Valley, which will have 100 rooms available at reduced rates for service members, along with the resort's ski terrain expansion. The Red Maple property has long been a part of Park City's long-term open space plan. The municipality agreed to buy the land from MIDA back in 2015. MIDA's board approved the deal in 2020. It became official last month after the Air Force signed off on the agreement. Park City is paying MIDA $2 million for the Red Maple parcel. Resident taxpayer dollars didn't contribute to the acquisition, according to the memo. The Air Force is receiving a 1.5-acre parcel at Deer Valley East Village as part of the transaction. $1.9 million from the sale will go towards MIDA's recent purchase of 42 affordable workforce housing units in East Village. MIDA is donating the remaining $100,000 to the Boys and Girls Athletic Programs at the Wasatch County School District. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
So members of the Park City Community Foundation's Women's Giving Fund voted to award $75,000 to the People's Health Clinic. The announcement was made on Wednesday at the annual grant celebration at Park City Mountain's Red Pine Lodge. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher was there. And
the winner is People's Health Clinic!
The more than 2,000 members of Women's Giving Fund vote every year to decide which of three local organizations should receive the annual high-impact grant. The fund started in 2014 when 1,000 women donated $1,000 each, raising an endowment of $1 million. This year's $75,000 grant to the People's Health Clinic was the largest ever awarded. People's Health Clinic provides free health care to the uninsured in Summit and Wasatch counties. When accepting the award, Women's Health Director Dr. Tanya Bodnar stood next to the mom-to-be who was featured in the finalist video members saw before casting their votes. They were also joined on stage with the patient's newborn daughter, Atanya.
I have delivered thousands of babies. I've performed thousands of surgeries. I don't quiver, but this is quiver worthy. You are incredible. Thank you.
People's Health Clinic CEO Mari Lining says the money will be used to elevate the women's health program.
Right now, we've got Tanya Bodnar working at max capacities, and where I feel like we can bring the program to another level is by adding a community health worker who can really do attentive, detailed follow-up with our patients. So when Dr. Bodnar wraps up with a patient, the community health worker would then go in and make sure that individual has everything they need to succeed.
People's Health Clinic last won the grant in 2019. Sue Banerjee, the executive director of PC TOTS, who won the award last year, says PC TOTS also won the first Women's Giving Fund grant 10 years ago. The funding, she says, can be life-changing for both women and children.
PC TOTS allows children to have a head start in life, be kindergarten ready. It allows women who want to work to be able to flourish in their chosen careers and ultimately create intergenerational wealth. That's what we're doing.
The other two finalists in this year's voting, Mountain Mediation and Summit Community Gardens and Eats, each received $25,000. After the winner was announced, an anonymous donor came forward and offered an additional $50,000 match to support each of the runner-up organizations up to $25,000 each. Every donation made to the Women's Giving Fund between now and July 31st will be matched with a donation to Summit Community Gardens and Eats and the Mountain Mediation Center. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
So Peyton Hawkins recently took an in-depth look at the Park City Senior Center in an article published in the Salt Lake Tribune on July 8th. She joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Peyton.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So how did the existing center end up in its, well, let's start with a little background. What is the Park City Senior Center, and how did it end up in its existing Woodside location?
Yeah, so the Park City Senior Center, it's one of, I think, three that Summit County, you know, funds. There's one, I think Colville is one. Anyway, so Park City is one of those, and it's been around in its current location since the late 70s. The building that it's in is actually an old railroad depot building that was in Keatley, which was, you know, the town that was flooded when we decided to ban the Provo River and make Jordanelle. And so, you know, all those years ago, the seniors got, you know, a deal that if they could move this building to Park City, they could have it. And they, you know, did fundraisers, all this stuff, and moved it to where it is now on Woodside Avenue, sort of near the library. And, you know, it's, I mean, the senior center is just a community center for seniors. You know, they host lunches there. It's, you know, it's kind of just a place to hang out, honestly, and they'll do some, you know, activities like workout classes and stuff there. But, yeah.
And who is its target audience to serve? What is sort of the demographic of it serves? Obviously, it's based on age.
Yeah. So you have to be 60 In order to become a member, you pay $5, you know, and then you're a member and you can come and participate or hang out, you know, participate in activities or hang out at the senior center. And then, you know, you can get the lunches. I think it's 2 times a week. You pay $3 for that. But yeah, it's kind of just, you know, a club almost, you know, for people 60 and older in Park City. And I mean, it's by far the most popular senior center in Summit County, you know, more popular than the other two. People, you know, drive in or bus in or whatever to Park City to specifically go to this center, even if they live in maybe a different Summit County town.
So as the demographics of Park City have changed, I take it that the senior center's membership has grown.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. You know, I think 5 years ago, the membership was under 100, and as it is now, it's more than 500 members. And I mean, some of that is because, you know, just the demographics of Summit County are changing. People are aging. It's this sort of national phenomenon called the silver tsunami is what it's called sort of nationally. And it's just, you know, as more and more baby boomers are reaching retirement age, you know, you would expect that more of them would reach the age that they could, you know, gain membership to the senior center. But then also, it seems to me that people are just kind of wanting to support it more, you know, like during the COVID-19 pandemic, it just became, you know, more obvious that the more time seniors or anybody honestly spends in isolation, the worse it is for their mental health. And so I think that growth in membership is also kind of an acknowledgement of just the importance of a center like this. And then also, I mean, people have been moving into Park City and retiring. You know, these are not all just people who have been in Park City, too. You know, some people are moving here and also kind of increasing the number of seniors here, too.
And given that massive growth in enrollment or membership, you know, how has that impacted the facility's ability to sort of serve its members? Is it kind of stretched at this point?
Oh, totally. I mean, they're bursting at the seams when you go there for lunch. It's like they have... So the original Railroad Depot building, I mean, it's pretty small. The whole center, I think, is about 3,000 square feet, and they've added on two small additions. But when you walk in there on a lunch day, and they have the tables set up with, you know, I think there's about a dozen tables, 7 chairs per table. So, I mean, the 80 or so, 70 people, you know, that show up, I mean, it's cramped in there. Like, when people would get up and try to walk behind my chair and stuff, I felt like I needed to scoot up really tight, which, I mean, as you can imagine, if people have mobility issues or something, you know, you don't want to have, like, a tripping hazard. So, yeah, they've totally outgrown this space.
Which sort of takes our segue into the what are the current plans for an alternative center, and how would that be financed?
Yeah. So this, I mean, the new senior center has been years in the making. I mean, you're probably familiar with that. There have been a few sort of iterations over past mayoral administrations where they've tried to sort of, you know, come up with a space that works. But the sort of, I don't know, the crux, I guess, of this issue has been that the seniors would really like to kind of stay where they're at. They really like where they're at. I mean, some people ski into the location that they're at now. You know, they don't want to be moved somewhere and that doesn't have the same, I don't know, views, amenities, and stuff like that they have now. And so they finally have a plan where they can sort of stay in place at their current location. But they're going to, in all likelihood, I think, raise the current senior center and then build something different that's probably about 7,000 square feet bigger. And then in addition to just being a senior center, it's also going to have affordable housing units around it, as well as some units for senior housing. And, you know, that's expected to be funded. I think the city has budgeted $3.5 million for it, for just the senior center part of it. And then the developer is going to actually finance the housing side of things.
And what is the timeline for having this happen? And what are some of the bureaucratic hoops that would have to be jumped through to get there?
Yeah, so right now, they've chosen a developer. The developer is going to have to go in front, like, you know, put their proposal in front of the you know, local government. They're going to have to sign off on it. And, you know, all of the, you know, requests for proposal documents said that they had hoped to break ground, I think in September, you know, this fall. But that might be a bit of an ambitious timeline. You know, talking to Mayor, well, she was saying that, you know, hopefully in the next year we'd be able to break ground. So, you know, maybe as early as September they'll break ground. Maybe it'll take a bit longer than that.
I know where I would place my bet. But anyway, what's going to happen? Are they going to actually tear down the old train station, or is there some talk about finding another use for it?
You know, there is some talk about finding another use for it. It's unclear if that's actually going to happen. But, you know, basically the way the seniors got it, you know, themselves was, you know, the deal, if you can move it, you can have it. And that's what I'm told they've offered to, you know, other nonprofits that might want to use this building, you know. And so that's yet to be seen. And, you know, obviously moving a building is big work and costly work. So we'll see what happens to it. It'd be sad if they just raised it. I mean, it's an old historic building, but, you know, onward and upward, I guess.
Well, it takes time and money to figure out a good use for it and to move it. So I could see why that would be a bit of a challenge.
Sure.
So let's put this into a bit of a larger context. We've been talking about how the demographics of Summit County are changing, and we're seeing an increased number of seniors. Adding out of 50 housing units, I understand a few are going to be for senior housing. What about the bigger picture in terms of the challenges faced for housing needs of seniors, both in general and specifically in terms of continuum of care kinds of developments? Is there anything, when you look at that at Summit County, how big a challenge is it?
I mean, I think it's a huge challenge. I mean, so sort of the issue that seniors are running into is that, you know, many of them who have been here, you know, their whole lives, you know, have their, you know, big houses or they've raised families and stuff like that. And so they've gotten to the point where, you know, they're, you know, maybe one or two people living in these large houses. They don't really need it anymore. But if they were to, you know, sell that asset, there's not really any place they could go to continue living in Park City where they want to be. You know, there are obviously some options. You know, there are some affordable housing units and stuff like that. But because they have these large assets, it's like they don't really, you know, qualify for affordable housing. And then there's not a lot of, you know, other housing they can move into. So that's, you know, that's one problem. And then say, you know, not only are you trying to downsize, but say maybe you fail or, you know, you start to have sort of memory issues or something like that. There's not a place outside of one center in Oakley in Summit County where you could go to get that sort of, you know, round the clock care. They're called CCRCs, continuing care retirement communities. And so there's only one of those in Summit County. And so the seniors, you know, some of the same seniors that are on this Park City Senior Center board have been advocating for literal decades to bring something like this to Summit County, because they've just seen, you know, so many of their friends and stuff who this has happened to. You know, one day they're fine, the next day they need more care, and they get shipped off to, you know, Salt Lake County or somewhere else, and they just, you know, the whatever community they had built in Summit County or Park City their entire lives, they no longer have access to, and it's just sad, you know. And so they would like to have some place where they can, you know, age where they want to in the county that they want to live in. And so that's kind of the next, you know, project that they're angling for.
You know, I think it sounds like it's an acute problem here in Summit County, but I don't know, Paige, as part of your reporting, have you looked at the sort of broader question of this issue for Utah as a whole? I mean, are we seeing, again, a lack of these kind of CCRCs? When you hold up the number of CCRC beds against the demographics of the aging population, are we headed for a larger crisis?
I mean, I have not done a lot of reporting sort of on the statewide issue, but I mean, I'm not too afraid to say yes. You know, it just seems like it doesn't seem like we have the resources for this. I mean, they talk about it as a silver tsunami or silver avalanche, and that implies that, you know, something big is coming that we're not prepared for. And I mean, it's the same thing with all sorts of other care centers across the state. There's just not enough. And maybe if there's a facility, there's not enough staff. You know.
Yeah, and you know, the financial implications, the cost of that kind of care is so high against the sort of resources that these people have that ultimately becomes a, you know, a government funding issue to a large extent. So anyway, complicated issue and no obvious answers. Paige, anything else you want to add before we go?
Definitely. You know, I don't think so. I think we covered it all. But yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
And thanks for being here. We'll be right back after this. Basin Recreation has adopted the same trail rules as Park City. That means speed limits and some e-bike bans. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more.
Now nearly all Park City area paths will have speed limits of 15 miles per hour. The limit applies to major bike paths such as the Rail Trail, Millennium Trail, and Poison Creek, but not single track.
And now e-bikes are banned on single track, with exceptions for those with a mobility disability or those who are 65 and older. The Park City Council adopted those rules in May, and Basin Recreation followed suit Wednesday at the Summit County Council. Here's Basin Rec Board Chair Brandy Connolly.
With as many visitors as we have to the community and residents, consistency helps with enforcement and practice and education.
The speed limits come after some residents raised concerns about high speeds on ever more crowded trails. Park City area resident of four decades, John Adams, says the gravel paths between his neighborhood of Silver Springs and Ranch Place aren't as safe as they used to be.
Now it has become a lot of motorbikes. And while we talk about e-bikes, it is a motorbike.
There are currently three classes of e-bikes recognized by regulators. Class 1 e-bikes are pedal-assisted but without a throttle, and they can reach 20 miles per hour. Class 2 e-bikes are pedal-assisted with a throttle and reach 20 miles per hour, too. Class 3 e-bikes are pedal-assisted, have no throttle, and reach 28 miles per hour. Even faster throttled e-bikes exist, but they don't fall within regulators' classification system. When it comes to the e-bike ban on single track, the exception for disabled and older people allows them to use Class 1 e-bikes only, so no throttle. Basin Rec says a survey of the Park City area shows about half of the city and Basin residents own an e-bike, less than 1 in 5 own an e-mountain bike. 7 in 10 survey respondents support speed limits. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Yesterday, the Utah Supreme Court issued the long-awaited decision in a case regarding redistricting. Here to talk about this important case and its implication is the lawyer who argued it for the Campaign Legal Center, Mark Gaber. Good morning, Mark, and thanks for joining us from Ireland.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, can you set the stage a bit by explaining the history of the 2018 ballot initiative and the subsequent legislative action? How do we get here?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2018, after decades of the legislature engaging in gerrymandering, the group got together and collected the petition signatures necessary to get a ballot initiative on the ballot for voters that would ban partisan gerrymandering and set up an independent redistricting commission to draw maps with citizen input and a robust process and advise the legislature and put standards on the legislature's power to ignore that map and standards on any map that they would put into effect after that. And the voters, by a majority vote in Utah, passed that in 2018. And that should have really been the end of the issue, that the redistricting map should have been adopted pursuant to that process. But instead, the legislature, for the first time in Utah's history, repealed the initiative that the voters had passed and instead watered it down with their own or fake version of a commission and ignored the maps that commission came up with and instead drew the map that we have, in effect now, that by all measures is an extreme partisan gerrymander.
I was going to ask you what the resulting districts look like. And just to remind our listeners, what did the current map do to, for example, Salt Lake City?
Salt Lake County is split into four pieces. Salt Lake City is split into several pieces, and there's four congressional districts in Utah, and they all meet in Mill Creek. And the city of Mill Creek is split four ways into you can go on a walk, and you walk through all four congressional districts.
Okay, Mark, what was the rationale? What was the justification put forth by the legislature for sort of overriding the view of the voters?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think that they have said that they think there's small pieces of the initiative system that they thought, they didn't think were legal, but not certainly not the whole thing. And with respect to the map, they came up with this justification that they thought all the districts should have both rural and urban parts, and I'm not sure why that's beneficial, but that's the most I've heard.
And of course, as you mentioned, there was a process by which a proposed sort of non-gerrymandered district, gerrymandered map was put forward, but the legislature simply, as I understand it, said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this one. Is that basically it?
That's right. And it was a robust process. It was a bipartisan process. Both Republicans, Democrats, Independents were all involved. They went around the state and collected feedback and on what communities of interest should look like and what the lines should be. And the commission came up with, I think, three or four proposals of different maps that would satisfy the public's input and meet the requirements that the voters adopted as part of the initiative process. And the legislature, had they not repealed the initiative, would have been required to vote up or down on those. And if they departed from them, to give reasons why they were doing that, why their map was better. Instead, they just, under a cloak of darkness one night, came up with their own pre-cooked map that split the county of Salt Lake into four pieces and disregarded entirely all of the work and all of the public input that happened as part of the commission process and involved the public not at all in the legislative process.
And without getting too nerdy here,
that's hard for me to do.
me too. I think our poor audience is suffering from hearing the conversation between two lawyers. But anyway, Mark, without being too nerdy here, was the legislative act technically a repeal of the initiative? Is that what they did to set this up?
Yeah, they repealed the entire initiative and then replaced it with a sort of a watered down version that they didn't actually have to follow. But for all intents and purposes, the key aspects of the voters' initiative, they just entirely repealed and got rid of them.
Wow. Okay, so that sets the stage. The redistricting, the initiative is repealed, and somebody says, you know what, I don't think that's legal, let's sue. Tell us who brought the lawsuit and what the theory was.
Well, so we represent the League of Women Voters of Utah, the Mormon Women for Ethical Government, and a group of individual voters, both Republicans and Democrats, who supported the initiative and said that this violated the Utah Constitution, which in its Bill of Rights says that all political power belongs to the people and that they have the power to reform or alter their government. They have that right. And quite clearly, by enacting the Proposition 4 in 2018, they were exercising that right to reform the government. And by repealing it, you know, we allege that violated that right that's inherent in the people.
And that, as I understand it, I saw some of the oral argument. That was, you know, sort of the centerpiece. And you know, while it's never easy to read where judges are going, it sure felt like that was resonating, and it turns out that it was. But I want to get to the decision, but let's talk a little bit. There were some skilled advocates on the other side. The lead lawyer, particularly argued, I thought was a very good lawyer. Tell us what their basic theory was. Why was it that, from their perspective, that clause in the Constitution could be ignored by the legislature?
They sort of cast that provision in the Bill of Rights as kind of puffery, not really, it doesn't really mean much. It's sort of values, but not actual rights. And that instead, because the initiative had been legislation passed by the people, that the legislature could exercise its power to just repeal that as if it were a statute that the legislature had passed. And that was sort of the essence of their argument, that this right was sort of not really a right per se, but instead just a value statement in the Constitution.
And sort of to go off on a tangent, I think there was then some argument about what I would call ping-ponging, where they would say, okay, well, the legislature can pass it, but you can the initiative can pass, and the legislature can undo it, and then the initiative can happen again. That seemed like a really far-out concept that they were espousing.
Yeah, I agree with you that the lawyer, Ms. Mina, is a very skilled advocate. I think that probably wasn't the most apt analogy to use to a ping-pong game, because as the justices said in the opinion, that wouldn't be a very competitive ping-pong match if that's the way that this worked, where the people could go through the arduous process of getting the thousands, tens of thousands of signatures they need across the state, run a campaign, get the voters to support it and vote for it, and then the next moment the legislature comes into session, they can just repeal it, and then, it ping-pongs back to the people to do it again if they want. And one of the things I found sort of alarming from the argument in the position of the state and the legislature was that, the legislature would be politically accountable if enough people had voted in favor of the initiative. And that here it was just, a small majority, but a majority. And that wasn't enough to hold the legislature politically accountable. And I just find that disturbing, given that we have a system of majority rule.
And again, without getting too deep into the weeds, can you summarize what the court said yesterday? Why did they throw this out?
So So what the court said was that this right in the Constitution that the people hold to reform and alter their government is a meaningful right, and that if the and when they pass an initiative that reforms the government, if the legislature is going to do something to impair that initiative, then it needs to show it needs to meet like a very high burden and show that there's a compelling justification for why they're altering it, and that they're altering it in the narrowest possible way in service of that justification. And so what the court did is that here's what this provision means, here's the standard, and they sent it back to the district court to apply that standard and to determine whether or not the repeal of Prop 4 satisfies that standard. And obviously we think it comes nowhere near satisfying that, so we're pretty confident in them.
Of course, that you've anticipated my next question, is which is what happens next. So there still remains some power of the legislature to alter an initiative, but it sounds like it's going to be really hard to justify.
In general. And that's if what the legislature is doing is impairing or impeding the purpose of the initiative. But if what the legislature is doing is making a technical correction or passing some additional law to help make it more administrable or to service the purpose of the people's initiative, then they can do that, and they're not impaired in any way in doing that. It's only when what they're doing is to try to frustrate how the initiative, the reform effort works, then they have to meet a much higher burden, and that's appropriate. That's how all constitutional rights are decided by courts.
And as you indicated, it sounds as though your position is that when it goes back to the district court, it's highly unlikely that SB 200 could possibly pass that kind of strict scrutiny muster.
I can't imagine how it could. I mean, they repealed the entire initiative, and so that's not narrow. That's the opposite of narrow. Yeah.
Okay, so how long do you think this process is going to take, and is it likely that it will affect the 2026 redistricting?
I'm certainly hopeful of that because, you know, as I just said, I think this is a pretty clear question that this repeal was inappropriate. And as the Supreme Court said yesterday, if we are correct about that, then it is likely that the congressional map, you know, the maps that are in place, they certainly didn't go through any of the process that Proposition 4 required. So they can't stand if we are correct about SB 200. And so, the district court has, when the judge had the case, before it went up to the Supreme Court, she moved very quickly, and I anticipate that the judge will do so again, and you know, understand the urgency of the issue.
Yeah, it seems like 8 years is probably long enough for the people's will to be frustrated to the extent that that's what this represents.
I think it's perhaps too long, right?
Okay. So let's talk about it. This is going to affect, the direct impact of this is on Utah congressional districts, the people we send to Washington. To what extent will it have an effect, will this decision sort of have a ripple effect on state legislature and other kinds of districts in the state of Utah?
Well, the legislative districts also did not comply with the Prop 4 process. The legislature didn't vote on the maps that the commission had proposed. They might turn up to be partisan gerrymanders as well, and so because of the scope of the Supreme Court's ruling on the Prop 4 issue, as opposed to our direct challenge to the map, that could very well implicate the legislative maps as well.
So do you anticipate that you or others will be involved in a new round of litigation to try to deal with that directly?
Well, I would hope, the legislature can read, and I would hope that they would consider complying with the law if that's what the district court rules. So we'll see, is I guess the answer to that question.
And I guess that takes us to a segue. And I do want to get to sort of, where this fits into a larger national picture of redistricting litigation. But before we do, the legislature's reaction yesterday was interesting. Why do you think that some of the statements from senior legislators in Utah were pretty fiery? What kind of justifications do you think they're trying to put forward?
I honestly was quite taken aback. I mean, I guess I wasn't surprised, but I was taken aback at some of the rhetoric. The idea that the Supreme Court had struck at the heart of the republic and that the economy of Utah was going to be affected by this, and I just was sort of head scratching. I mean, the idea that Utah will fail to function if we stop suppressing the votes of a quarter or more of its citizens strikes me as a little backwards. And so I don't know if perhaps it was the first time there's been a recognition that the Constitution limits their power, if they haven't come to grips with that. But it struck me as a little tone deaf and kind of over the top.
Okay, Mark, before we go, tell us a little bit more about your organization. You're involved in, you know, litigation of this type around the country, as I take it.
Yes, we do redistricting, voting rights, campaign finance. We're all about making sure that democracy works best for everyone and that everyone has an opportunity to participate equally.
And, Mark, are there other states where legal challenges to gerrymandered redistricting are going on, and what is the status of those?
Yeah, there's litigation all over the country. Every 10 years, when we do redistricting, there is invariably going to be litigation about it. Our organization recently won a big case in Wisconsin about the state legislative map there that had been badly gerrymandered, perhaps one of the worst gerrymandered states since 2010, and that map has now been overturned, and there's a new fair map in place there. There's litigation about the Voting Rights Act in states around the country, but we've seen a lot of that be resolved here in the past few years, but there are certainly still cases going on. So Utah will not be alone in having continued litigation about its redistricting maps.
Okay. Mark, tell before we go, what is the name of your organization and what's the website if people want to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. We're the Campaign Legal Center, and folks can go to campaignlegal.org and learn more about our work. And if they feel so inclined, I will always welcome a contribution.
All right. Well, I completely understand that. We've been talking to Mark. Is it Gaber or Gaber?
Gaber. It's Gaber.
All right. Mark Gaber of the Campaign Legal Center about the earth-shaking decision by the Utah Supreme Court on redistricting. We'll be right back after this. The Park City Council had its regular meeting yesterday. On the phone with a debrief is Council Member Jeremy Rebell. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning, Roger. How are you?
I'm doing well. So, Jeremy, I guess the largest part of your session yesterday involved the Bonanza Park Small Area Plan. First of all, help people understand what that is and how it relates to the formerly known Arts and Culture District acreage owned by the city.
Sure. So the Bonanza Park area is basically from Deer Valley Drive down 224/Park. Over to where the Snow Creek Plaza is, and then heading east essentially to Bonanza Drive, so on the other side of the cemetery there. And the area you're talking about, that was the Arts and Culture District, now we refer to it as kind of a five-acre parcel, is within Bonanza Park. But last night we were talking about the larger district, not necessarily the 5 acres specifically.
And let's talk about, just from a sort of a step-back perspective, we have an area, it's got an existing sort of, it's subject to existing zoning and other regulations. I take it what's happening here is the city is asking itself, okay, what do we see in the future and how do we as a city create an environment for which that, for something good to happen? Is that basically what's going on here, is you're looking at changing the zoning and other kinds of rules?
Yeah, everything's on the table. It's the center of town, right? So the simpler way to think about the area is if you looked at a map of Park City and drew a circle in the middle, it's that area. We also have Main Street, which is really a commercial center at the moment, but geographically, this is, further towards where all the roads kind of meet. So what do we want there, right? Our bike paths merge, our roads merge. We have a lot of businesses. Right now, it's pretty light on residential, but it's surrounded by residential. We really are looking to promote a vibrant community gathering place that's complementary to our other districts, like Prospector and Main Street. So that's what this is all about.
And what was the discussion about last night? What did you learn? Where do you go from here?
Yeah, so there's a very brief 100-page plan.
which I tried to look at this morning.
Yeah, it probably takes a little longer, right? It has really good stuff in it, though, and would encourage folks who are interested to take a look. It's the culmination of the last year plus of public engagement and other planning activities that have been going on to really paint a picture of what good looks like and provide that framework. So what we did last night is we approved that, acknowledging what we've heard from our community and giving some direction to the process. And now it'll go forward with the Planning Commission to consider if we do need to create some new zoning or changes to our zoning or anything else.
And so again, just trying to understand the mechanics of this. What you're trying to do is create an environment, a legal environment, if you will, where the kinds of development that you want to see happen happens. And I take it that's something that would have to happen over time, because obviously there's existing stuff there that isn't going to disappear overnight. So what's the timeline for sort of getting to where you want to be?
I think of it more of a evolution of the area than wiping the slate. And the timeline's indefinite, right? So really this is a land use framework.
Right.
There's a lot of projects in the area that have been coming forward and voicing their intent to do something at some point in the near future. And we wanted a common playbook to kind of take us to that next chapter in our city.
And what kinds of details do you think, is what you do at the council level more or less a framework? So what kind of details need to be ironed out both at the council level and at the Planning Commission level?
There's a lot of different levers, right? Density is always one. Building height's always one. We gave direction on that to be consistent with our current policies. We talked a lot about what we call the frontage protection zone, which essentially is how far back from a street development can start, right? To give it kind of that park-like feel versus more of a downtown city feel. It goes on and on. The allowed uses of housing and commercial mixed use, we could ramble on, but there's a lot of different things here.
Okay. And again, we talked about how this is adjacent to, the what we call the 5-acre parcel. How do the two interrelate?
Well, the 5-acre parcel would likely be subject to whatever happens from the change in zoning or new zoning for the entire area. So, we're really big on the city should play by the same rules as private landowners, essentially. So we didn't want to create something that was specific to city-owned land that private landowners in the same district couldn't leverage. And this promotes that consistency.
And before we leave the 5-acre parcel, where are we?
Well, that's a good one. So the RSOQ, it's also highly technical.
Okay, here we go.
Yep, the RSOQ, we're getting responses. There's been a lot of interest expressed, is what we're being told. So that's really exciting. Hopefully we get a number of quality responses that basically qualify bidders who move forward in the process. Concurrently, we're working on our request for proposals, which is where we're going to go out and say, here are our requirements of what we want to see on those 5 acres, and see what professional development and architecture firms bring us and who wants to work with us on it.
And remind us when the RSOQ deadline is and when we could see a decision on that phase of this process.
I think we're expecting in the next month or so here to have a pretty good picture of what the results of that RSOQ was, and then the RFP we're working to get out there, I believe, by the end of August, early September.
I guess, anything else we should touch on in this regard?
No, it's exciting, right? This is actually a huge step forward. The wheels are turning now, which I think the community is going to be really, really excited to see.
Yes, I think everybody wants to see something happen at this point, given the length of time that you guys have been wrestling with this. Another thing you guys touched on last night was the Nonprofit Service Advisory Committee. First of all, what is that?
So this is another evolution. We're, moving our processes forward as the city grows and things get a little more complex. This is an effort to really provide an opportunity for nonprofits in our community to apply for funding from the city in categories that support the priorities of the council.
Are the rules for who's going to be eligible to sit on that committee?
There are. We were talking about them a bit last night, and there was some discussion, some opinions around should folks be residents of Park City proper, which, you know, essentially is 84060, at least in our immediate area there. Should they work in Park City? Should folks from the broader area be eligible? Should folks who sit on nonprofits or involved with nonprofits be eligible? There was some discussion there.
How do you feel about some of those things, Jeremy? What's your take on the, for example, the should, you know, given that we're dealing with city money, should it be city taxpayers who are the only ones eligible to sit on the committee?
So my personal opinion, not speaking for the council as a whole here, I would say personally I do feel like at least a majority of the committee should be Park City taxpayers because they're spending taxpayer money. And the other spot should be filled by folks who have a very strong presence in Park City proper, perhaps just working in the city, or, you know, if staff can come up with some other qualifiers that makes sense, that'd be fine too.
And how long do you think it'll take this process to drive to a conclusion? When are you guys going to sort of decide and formally impanel this board?
They said they'd come back to us in August, so we should know then.
Okay, so Jeremy, the front page of the paper last week indicated that Mayor Worrell was going to get to go to the Olympics. I take it you didn't get a trip to Paris?
No. Okay. No, I won't be going.
Okay, but that's sort of our segue to the larger question of, you know, what is your perspective on what the city can and should be doing to leverage the potential of the Olympics here, assuming that things go as we hope in a couple of weeks? What kind of opportunities does this present for the city, and how should we try and take advantage of them?
Well, there's a ton of opportunity. I mean, big picture, it's really exciting, right? It's exciting to be part of this process. I think it's exciting that we're going to have a seat at the table and have official representation at these discussions when they happen here in a couple weeks. And the outcome, right, is potentially 10 years from now, but that's not that long. And really what we have to think about is how are we proactive? How can we promote infrastructure projects? How can we promote things like Bonanza Park and start putting these frameworks in to really evolve Park City to the next step in our life cycle?
And again, sort of to get specific, is there anything that you personally, is there one piece of this that if you could say, this is what I hope we can do, is there anything that you've thought about that fits into that sort of narrow category of this is what I hope we can accomplish from the Olympic opportunity?
No, not specifically. Not honestly, I would say, in my opinion, it's very on brand for us as a city, and all of the things that we believe in and promote and do anyway, this is just sort of validation that those are the same things, right? And this gives us an opportunity to maybe do them a little quicker, which is nice.
Yep.
But outside of that, I think we're on a pretty good track.
Anything else you want to touch on before we go, Jeremy?
Yeah, I do want to mention the city did approve a ignition source ban related to wildfires last night, and it's important to get out there to the community. So essentially, you know, barbecues are allowed, right? Charcoal or gas barbecues, as long as they're used per the manufacturer's specifications. But nothing else that creates a spark or open flame is allowed without a permit. We're at a very high fire danger, and it's very important. These things go bad quickly. So we love everyone's participation and support of the ban. And if you do see open flames or whatnot, please report it.
And as we got Pioneer Day coming up, I assume that includes fireworks within city limits.
It does, yes. Fireworks would require a permit from the city.
Okay. Jeremy, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Roger. Have a great day.
We'll be right back after this. Despite Wasatch County leaders' best intentions of collaborating on a statement about the future bypass road, consensus remains elusive. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the latest.
Representatives from the Wasatch County, Heber City, and Midway City Councils and the Wasatch County School District held an interlocal meeting Wednesday evening to discuss issues that affect the whole Heber Valley. Top of mind was what the group now calls the Heber Valley Corridor, popularly known as the Bypass. It's a road intended to draw highway traffic away from the heart of Heber's downtown. Leaders currently hope to finish construction in time for the anticipated 2034 Olympic Games. But to begin construction, they need the Utah Department of Transportation to announce its preferred route. At Wednesday's meeting, Heber City Councilmember Yvonne Barney read aloud a draft of a letter to UDOT asserting the willingness of local agencies to collaborate so the Valley can build the road. The letter outlines five priorities for the highway: preserving open space in the North Fields, preserving the beauty of the Heber Valley, reducing traffic, supporting the success of Heber's downtown, and minimizing environmental impact. Barney emphasized the importance of local entities working together and called the traffic issues a valley-wide problem.
We have an opportunity to do this and to do it right. And the only way that we can do it right is by first sharing with UDOT what we want from this bypass, what we're looking for.
Wasatch County Councilmember Mark Nelson worried the letter might not have its intended effect, imagining how UDOT officials might read it.
I would say to myself, I already know all of these five things because you told them to me a million times over the last year and a half. Saying that you support it, and here are five things that make that support almost impossible.
Others in the room pushed back and said it's vital to communicate to UDOT that the Heber Valley communities are on the same page. Wasatch County Council Chair Spencer Park suggested everyone take additional time to discuss the bypass in upcoming meetings. The group intends to have a final letter to share with UDOT by mid-August. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.